Hi, this is John Udell. My guest for this week's podcast is Lou Rosenfeld. He was the co-author of the popular book Information Architecture for the World Wide Web. Now he's writing a new book on search analytics, and his own new company will be publishing the book. In this conversation, we talk about a lot of our favorite topics, including print and online publishing, search analytics, information architecture, tagging, microformats, and why the skills of librarians and library scientists could wind up being in greater demand than ever. Lou, hi, this is John Udell. How you doing?
Hey, John. How are you?
I was just reviewing your, I guess it was your first book, Information Architecture for the World Wide Web, which came out when, in 98, 9?
First edition was 98, the second one was 2002.
Okay, and you have another one in the works?
Yep, we hope to have the third edition out, I guess, at the end of this year.
Okay. Well, one of the things that occurred to me was to review how you had defined information architecture originally and ask how you think the principles and practices are evolving. The four definitions up front are, one, the combination of organization, labeling, and navigation schemes within an information system. Two, the structural design of an information space to facilitate task completion and intuitive access to content. Three, the art and science of structuring and classifying websites and intranets to help people find and manage information. And four, an emerging discipline and community of practice focused on bringing principles of design and architecture to the digital landscape. In looking through the book again, it's been a while since I looked at it, I was struck by the degree to which, although I think all of those definitions still hold, a lot of change has happened. The first thing that came to me in looking through the stuff on labeling and classification is the degree to which, you know, certainly unanticipated by me and maybe by you, this collective tagging phenomenon has taken off. I'm curious what you think is going on there and if that is, in fact, a fundamental sea change and what that means.
That's a really good question, and actually when we started looking at what would be different about our third edition and the second one, which came out 4 years ago and was really written 5 years ago, you know, everyone talks about Web 2.0 and especially in the IA context, folksonomic tagging.
Mm-hmm.
If you kind of scratch the surface with that stuff, it's not really new in principle. It's definitely been revolutionary in practice that so many people are thinking about tagging and more broadly about how they develop metadata. I mean, we're all becoming metadata publishers in a way.
Mm-hmm.
But the sort of more traditional approach to metadata is a more controlled one, and we use the term controlled vocabularies to describe predetermined sets of metadata. And, you know, this is a really obvious, blindingly obvious example. Think of postal codes for states. We encounter these all the time. But even those kinds of traditional metadata approaches have always had some user input. They haven't just been exclusively the domain of subject matter experts and librarians and other specialized people.
So what's an example of, I don't know, to take the Dewey Decimal System, for example, of ways in which it was informed by non-librarians?
Well, simply the fact that the content that metadata describes itself is always changing, and so any good set of metadata evolves to keep up with the moving target of what it's describing. And
okay,
anyone who is worth his salt and is involved in metadata development is looking to grow what they're doing by encountering changes in the content and the language that's in that content. People have been using all kinds of interesting techniques in a variety of, I think, pretty unpublicized ways, like doing things like tracking search logs and seeing how people are users are describing content. That's
mm-hmm.
a lot in common with the tagging.
Yes,
it's just a little less explicit, but it's got a lot of parallels. And people in the library world have been looking at that on and off for years, and some have been applying that to metadata development. It's not a black and white thing. There's a continuum of how much users or content authors have been involved in the development of metadata.
Exactly.
We're just starting to figure this out. And
exactly. And we tend to dichotomize these things, yeah, as always. And so now there is a tendency to set the formal taxonomies in opposition to the grassroots taxonomies.
Well, the thing that really frustrates me is that if you take the opposite extremes, they can still and should still coexist and inform each other. Mm-hmm. I know IBM is doing this. They have a 3,700 term controlled vocabulary that they use on their intranet, and now they have dog ear, which is their version of delicious. And, if they're not already, because they're somewhat secretive about it, I'm sure they're going to find a lot of opportunities to have what I would call a metadata ecology, where they're being informed by a lot of the user-supplied tagging, both in terms of what terms should make it into their controlled vocabularies.
Yes.
But also, just in terms of understanding how needs are changing, especially in highly fluid, dynamic subject areas like high tech. You kind of have to have that user input in order to simply have your own metadata keep up.
Well, I highlighted a passage from the book that is quite relevant here. At one point, you say, the users of a site may be telling you directly or indirectly what the labels should be. This isn't the easiest information to get your hands on, but if you can, it's the best source of labeling there is.
And that's certainly easier now if your users, in a fairly contained way, are using a system like Delicious.
Yeah. The part that is not yet well understood is that it's enlightened self-interest at work, so that the classification that I do of stuff that's interesting to me in Delicious is primarily for my own use. Mm-hmm. And the collective benefit is simply a happy consequence. And I think this ties into your interest in search analytics, right? So, mm-hmm. As I understand it, you're going to be doing a book on the whole question of what can you learn from search logs, and why don't people pay closer attention to the information that is in search logs, and I would imagine by extension, how can you personalize or feed back to people, close the loop, basically, using an iterative approach to help them refine what it is that they're looking for and help them remember what they looked for before, things like that.
Yeah, it's interesting. Is search going to be used in the same sort of way as something like Delicious for personal refindability? I don't know. Possibly, and there are probably some improvements there that you could make based on search analytics. I think a lot of the benefits that we're going to find are kind of even more basic than that. For example, the really common things we're going to ask our search logs are things like, what are the most common searches? And of them, which ones are really striking out? You might want to look, first of all, at your top 100 most common queries. You might have to do a little bit of processing on your logs to come up with those. It's not that hard. And actually, we provide a free Perl script in our book's site to do that. We hope someone will write some other versions of that script in other languages. But in any case, just knowing that if you're Caterpillar, the most common search is boots, it's pretty interesting. Boots? Well, when they first encountered that, they were probably pretty surprised. But when you think about it, Caterpillar is in the lifestyles business as well as in the heavy machinery business. And they sell about $1 billion a year in boots and belt buckles and cat hats and stuff like that. That wasn't a huge revelation for them, but when you dig a little deeper and see that people are commonly typing product codes and yet your system isn't able to retrieve product information that way, or that they're typing something that that you have content for and yet they're not retrieving it, they're getting zero hits for a common query.
Mm-hmm.
It's a real problem. So search analytics is just this, we're finding it to be a fabulous diagnostic tool in a number of ways. So that example of, here's a common query, people aren't getting anything. Does that mean you don't have the content? Well, get the content. Does it mean the content is not tagged well, or does it include in its full text the appropriate terms to match what users are going to be likely to search for it by?
Mm-hmm.
That's something you can fix. Are they just coming up with typos? Are they mistyping a product name that's hard to type or that's easy to forget how to spell? There are some fixes for that. Might be spell checking. There are so many improvements that come directly out of looking at search analytics.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that particularly fascinates me is the notion of search strategies. This mm-hmm. is something that is rarely articulated, is usually a sort of a tacit understanding, if there is even any understanding. And I, you know, the other day I saw a column by Sean McGrath, who's the CTO of Propylon, in which he was reflecting on the way search has changed his modes of information retrieval and management. And he was pointing out that, well, he rarely bookmarks things anymore because he knows that he can just search and find them again. And at one point he said a particular question came up and he noticed that he was mentally formulating the search strategy that would lead to the answer to the question. Over the last couple of days, actually, I've been going through this exercise of trying to make those strategies explicit. And it's really quite interesting. And one of the things it leads to is the observation that looking at the search logs of a particular site will tell you a lot of useful basic stuff as the provider of the information on that site. Mm-hmm. But search strategies cross boundaries. And so, you know, it would also be extremely helpful to have a broader view from the perspective of the person, from the searcher's perspective. You know, so for example, I was looking for something that I eventually found by way of Google, but in order to recall the kinds of terminology that would be useful to present to Google, I had to remember who the people were who were involved in this area that I was investigating, and then I used other resources, probably Technorati, to find their blogs, and then I used local navigation and search on their blogs in order to get into the neighborhood of the stuff that was, you know, would supply me ultimately with the query terms that I would feed to Google. So it was quite an interesting orchestration, really, of different things.
When you don't have the bullseye terms to type into that box, you've got to kind of go for the outer areas, the sort of overlapping areas, and kind of go for the edges, really, until you get closer into that bullseye.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times we don't know exactly what we're looking for. So I think you've hit on a really important point. You know, one of the things you can learn a little bit from analyzing queries is a sense of whether people are doing what's called known item searching. For example, they type in the actual product number. They know it's there, they know exactly what they want, and they know how to articulate it in characters. At the other end of the spectrum is, you know, the situation you just described, where you don't really know what you're looking for. You're going to try, and as you move through the information and iterate, what you're looking for changes, and what you type changes.
Or actually, in this case, I did know what I was looking for. What I lacked were the words mm-hmm. that would access the documents related to that fairly well-defined thing. Because not being in that community of practice, I didn't have that vocabulary at hand. So it's that classic conundrum of you're searching for words, and you need to use those words to do the search, right? And so how do you break that cycle? And those indirect strategies that I used were involving really a federation of different websites and mm-hmm. navigation systems and search services, which led me to reflect on the degree to which really all information providers not only do a pretty lousy job on the basics, which is to say navigation and search,
mm-hmm.
but also really never contemplate what the benefit to them would be of exporting programmatic access, for example, to search. Every site should provide machine-readable search results and should be providing search results in ways that are organized along a number of different obvious metadata axes and so on, and that the kinds of federated constructs that could be built around that would, at least in my view, would be helpful to everyone.
you know, fortunately we seem to be somewhat moving in that direction. But I think, you know, you're hitting on a really important point, which is people are understanding that search is not so simple. And, you know, one of the real reasons that search performs so generally poorly is that we associate search with a search engine specifically.
Mm-hmm.
And organizations buy that piece of software,
mm-hmm.
and they hand it over to IT. And IT people often have a very data-driven understanding of search from the database world, where you know what you're looking for, and you know the answer is there. And that's a pretty simple, often non-iterative, non-federated, non-integrated way of finding information. So now we're trying to rip that mentality apart and get all kinds of people involved with the design of search and its integration with other ways of finding information. So, you know, that transition is happening. I hope this book is going to help that happen to some degree. I hope information architecture as a field is helping that happen, because we tend to be very agnostic about ways of getting people to information and very pro-iteration and integration. We are the natural allies of people who want to do what you just described. There's another point here that I think is implicit in what you're saying, which is, all right, so you just described how you might find information in a very iterative, integrative fashion. And a lot of what's going on is, if you want to understand what John Udell is doing when he's trying to search, it's not just happening when John is interacting with the search engine. A lot of it is happening in your mind,
mm-hmm.
and as you interact with other types of information, both on the web, but in other places too, maybe in print, maybe on your office wall, what have you. This is why I'm so interested in user experience as a field, because UX has methods that it pulls together from all sorts of existing disciplines to help understand that bigger picture. So I might want to look at something like the method called contextual inquiry, which originates in ethnography,
mm-hmm.
to understand what's going on with you and what your thinking is before you actually sit down to search, because that's pretty important, and that's part of your process of finding information. As important as what happens when you actually start typing and hitting the submit button.
Mm-hmm.
So how do all these methods come together is really critical. There are other methods out there, and I think there's a lack of understanding of all the various tools that true professional designers of every type should be aware of and able to integrate.
As a former library scientist, you are among the group of professionals for whom search strategy is a conscious and explicit set of skills. Librarians typically deploy that skill set on behalf of their patrons. But what I'm particularly interested in is, in your experience, what is teachable about search strategy?
Boy, you're asking me to dust off stuff from so many years ago. It's been about 15 years since I've been in library school. But one thing is to get people to understand the concept of information literacy. So, you know, if you just do searching, you're going to turn up all sorts of stuff, and you may be satisfied. You may not have found the best information or the most relevant information, and you may not know. So, you know, ignorance is bliss, but it's not necessarily the best outcome.
Mm-hmm.
And so often we discuss issues like, you know, not just when you're searching the web for any kind of random interest, but when you have mission critical needs, like you have a family member who's just come down with an illness.
Mm-hmm.
You need to very quickly educate yourself about that illness, and you may be the primary caregiver. What do you do? You could go to Google and you could turn up a bunch of things, and some of it might be okay, some of it might be crap. You don't really know. In that situation, you need to be a bit more aware of what kind of information you need. What are the kind of characteristics for assessing appropriate information for that need? For example, authority when it comes to medical information needs is pretty critical. And you probably want to go to the Centers for Disease Control to learn about a health issue rather than someone's personal site. So, you know, we often bring up kinds of mission-critical issues as a way to get people to understand that just doing the sort of basic mindless typing stuff in a Google box isn't necessarily always your best way to go about it.
So trying to encourage some critical thinking about the quality of results and the breadth of sources,
right,
you're saying it's possible to do that when there's extremely high motivation, perhaps. That's when it's a teachable moment, is when somebody's in trouble and they really, you know, just can't settle for Google's top 10. You know, then they'll be
Absolutely. Then they'll be
receptive to a discussion about, well, there are more sources in the world and they have varying degrees of authority, and here's how you would think about evaluating them.
You know, you can try to teach it, but ultimately Planet is undergoing a crash course in global information literacy thanks to tools like Google and the web as a whole. We are becoming so information-focused that just to see the kind of conversations that happen broadly over issues like, is Wikipedia better or worse than Britannica, is exciting to see. It means people are thinking about exactly those issues.
True.
It's a lot easier now because these conversations happen organically than trying to teach people in a classroom at a library 15 or 10 years ago.
True. I think you're right. I mean, on the one hand, there are discussions about the quality of information, even in general discourse, which is an encouraging thing. On the other hand, I think that folks are right to point out that for a whole lot of people, the common denominator is pretty poor, and people are all too willing to settle for the top 10 on Google. And as you know, I mean, the entire premise of web search is that a person can type in one or two terms. And as somebody who's done a lot of search systems over the years, you basically have two populations of folks who use your systems, right? There's everybody, and then there are librarians, you know, and everybody will type in 1.3 terms. And librarians will push the boundaries in terms of combined queries, and they know how to quote things, and they know how to discover. I mean, you know, like, how many people know the numeric range feature of Google search, for example? It's probably the quickest way to get a snapshot view of what housing prices are in a given area, right? By just putting in, you know, like 100,000 .150,000 as part of your query. And I bet not one person in 1,000 knows that.
Kind of getting back to Web 2.0, the fact that we can sort of be, you know, mixologists of content, that we are producers, we are publishers, and we often get into it just because it's fun, is an education toward being a better consumer.
Mm-hmm. So, I did fill out your survey.
Thank you.
for the new book on, and one of the questions there was something like, why do you think people don't pay more close attention to their search logs? And I forgot to include a funny little anecdote, which is that, you know, every time I put up a system that logs search and I wait for the first request to come in, it's always interesting. You know, what will be the first thing that someone searches for? And the last time I did this, I put up an experimental system and announced it on my blog, and I was looking at the console for the first query to come in. And this was a query of, you know, my blog, right?
Okay.
And the first search query was for Adrian Barbeau.
Right. I mean, it's bizarre. And I remember a story about an intranet launch where all the executives are like there for the ribbon cutting, and like the first search on this intranet was like Christina Aguilera.
Right.
But, you know, I mean, it's bizarre, and yet it's just so fascinating. I've talked about search analytics as a diagnostic tool, but it has a lot of other potential. For example, a fellow I know at the Financial Times, Guy Valerio, what he does is he looks at his logs for spikes in names of individuals and companies.
Mm-hmm.
And when he sees a sudden spike, he compares it to recent editorial coverage.
Mm-hmm.
And if he sees a disparity, he'll bring it to the attention of the editors there.
That's a great point. In other words, this should have produced more interest in this person or this topic and didn't.
Well, and then they have the choice of sending someone whose beat that is out to check it out.
Mm-hmm.
So it becomes, it can be impactful on the editorial agenda where, you know, in this case, the Financial Times is actually, in a way, directly responding to users' needs.
So back to the user experience, I'm totally on board with the whole idea of observing people as they use internet tools. One of the things that I've been really interested in over the last couple of years is the application of the technology of recording screen videos, or what I've come to call screencasts, with audio narration. And it has lots of different uses, but one of the ones that I find pretty interesting is that it creates the opportunity to do a really decentralized and inexpensive kind of usability lab study. Right. Because it's pretty expensive to bring somebody into the, I think they call it the fixed lab, right? Where you bring basically people into a room and there's the one-way mirror.
Right.
You observe them. You know, they have a set of tasks to perform. You know, this is something that if it ever happens in the life of a software product or an information system online, is going to happen maybe, you know, once a cycle, because it's just, it's a big deal to do it, right? So, but the observation that you can, in this day and age, you can deploy, if you will, probes out there in the field that will sit on people's computers, and you know, wouldn't it be interesting if we could gather just lots more of this observation of people as they use or attempt to use tools and systems?
Absolutely. I do know of instances of people using WebEx to actually run task analysis exercises.
Mm-hmm. That's
been written up a little bit. And actually, as a publisher, I'm looking for someone to write a book on remote user experience methods.
Hmm.
I think there's a lot of applicability there, especially as a lot of what I work in when I do information architecture consulting is in the enterprise environment, where you have such a spread of users all over an organization and often all over the planet that you can't be in all the places that you would ideally need to be using a sort of traditional approach to doing user testing.
You know, I think probably the major impediment is that it's just so scary as the designer of a system or the developer of software to actually confront the reality of people using your stuff, that the tendency is just to not want to look. You know, it's just so hard.
That's why it's so important to have people involved who don't find that scary.
Yeah.
That people who are in the user experience world, you know, that's the scary part to them are the things that might not seem scary to the developers.
Yeah.
And you know, the UX person's plaint is not, oh gosh, I can't stand watching someone use the product. It's, oh gosh, you know, I love watching that, and I've come up with all kinds of great data that will inform improvements, but I can't get anyone to listen to me inside the organization to actually move ahead and take action on those improvements.
Yeah, yeah. One other thing I wanted to ask you about, I'm kind of jumping around here, but in looking through the book again, I noticed a concept that is pretty near and dear to my heart. And I think the example was, you had a page of a site, and it was a site that published recipes. And you had a screenshot of the recipe, and you said, well, there's not much information architecture here, is there? And then the comment was, well, actually there is. And it's in the microstructure, or what we would now call maybe micro format of the stuff. So, you know, the recipe is actually just a chunk of content that has, in fact, a consistent and differentiated internal structure.
Right.
I think about that. Well, I'm just obsessed, actually, with that whole idea, and have myself for a long time in the stuff that I write and the stuff that I publish been organizing stuff at the paragraph and subparagraph level in ways that are open to structured search.
Hard to write that way. Very hard to write that way.
You know, in a way it is, but in a way, well, tell me what you think. Here's my claim. My claim is that although we've always talked about the imperative to separate content from presentation, that in a funny kind of way, we know that people do obsess about presentation. And we know that given the opportunity to fiddle with styles, they will fiddle with styles obsessively. It occurred to me a while ago that obsessive fiddling with styles, which we tend to think we should discourage, is actually another one of the ways in which people are telling you directly or indirectly, what the labels should be, if you will. And so the emphasis and styling that people use on their stuff, actually, I've come to see, is in some way semantic. And that therefore it ought to be encouraged and supported with things like style sheets, which from the author's perspective are serving no other purpose than to help them make stuff look quote unquote good, or to look like other things that they want it to imitate. But from the information architect's point of view, are cues that can be used from a semantic perspective to do this deep structured search.
I think you have a really good point. The big roadblock, of course, is that primary platform for authoring content is unfortunately poorly designed and proprietary, and it's almost as if we're going to have to blow up Word, come up with a good alternative that would allow a community of designers and developers to not only notice the kinds of things that you're noticing, but act on those.
Well, yes and no. I mean, on the one hand, Word has a robust system of style sheets, and on the other hand, since Office 2003, Word has a robust system for translation to and export to XML. The tools are there. I think it's the attitude that's missing.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's what I'm sort of saying, is it almost has to come from people using tools like that. I mean, look at, you know, the kind of work that 37 Signals does.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't invent a whole lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They recreated certain inventions in collaboration with the user community.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, the users are actually aware of changes, having input into changes, maybe even affecting them themselves.
Yeah.
Whereas a lot of what's in, you know, any typical Microsoft package is behind a big wall, and there's often a lot of interface and other design problems that could be really improved on if they had a lot more user involvement.
I think that's right. And I think that the enlightened self-interest will come into play here again. So, for example, take recipes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in this day and age, if you're doing a recipe site, you will find it very interesting to be able to federate your recipe site with other recipe sites. And it will be in your interest when people are doing aggregations of recipe sites that your stuff show up in those aggregations. And if the ante is that you need to have published your stuff to the web according to a micro format that will be recognized by the aggregators, number one, which, you know, if it isn't true today, it will be pretty soon. And number two, if it's the case that Word or any other popular word processor does a good job of enabling you to compose those recipes in the friendly way that you like, but publish them in the micro format that will be sucked up by that aggregator and give you the global exposure and the connectivity that you want, you know, then that's how you're going to close the feedback loop there, I think.
Do you think Google Base is an attempt to do that?
The bottleneck is the production of micro formats and the publication of them. There just is so little of that going on. And to the extent that it does happen, it's absolutely trivial for anyone to scoop up mm-hmm. the stuff and aggregate it. You know, I mean, anyone can do it. It doesn't even require a consensus necessarily about what the exact format is. It only requires regularity. And so if there are five or six different recipe micro formats, you know, that's not ideal, but ultimately intermediaries can normalize away the differences, just in the same way that we've got like eight or nine different flavors of what we call RSS.
Right.
You know, but right, I mean, it, you know, we normalize that stuff out, right? It's just that the production of regularity in content, you know, is the thing. And, you know, that requires an incentive, and the incentive has to be, well, it's in my interest to do it, right? And I'm not doing it for the greater good. It's because it's in my interest that when I publish this stuff, it's going to show up in these aggregations, right? And then it's, you know, what does the best job of letting me write the stuff in the way that I want to, but gives me the outputs that I need that will plug into this larger system.
Well, as an information architect, I hear your optimism and share it, but that opens a whole other can of worms because, you know, aggregation is based on common structure or common enough structure. Mm-hmm. And once you get structure down, the next big challenge is semantics.
Mm-hmm.
And as we move toward a world where we have so much more interoperability because of shared structures and formats, it's going to really force the issue of, well, how do we find our way through that big bucket of aggregated whatevers,
mm-hmm.
whether it be recipes or products or job descriptions or what have you. And the sort of obvious way, the easy way to create some sort of semantic interoperability is almost always going to be based on popularity,
mm-hmm.
as Google has proven with the open web.
Yep.
And that's going to be better than what we have today, but it's going to be problematic in terms of, well, are we locking the planet into everything being driven by a PageRank style algorithm?
Here's what I would say about that. I'm going to say that we have the same, I don't know what the number is, pick your number, you know, 15, 20, 25,000 communities of interest, communities of practice on the web. And 15 years ago, the materialization of those communities of practice were 15 or 20 or 25,000 Usenet news groups. So what you had was people self-identified on the web and whose contributions were in a context within which popularity meant something different than it means on the open global web. But what we never got to with that organization was the sort of cultivation and long-term memory and deep search within those communities, right? Because just because of the architecture of the Usenet, it was transient, right? And it replicated, and there was never any history, and there was never any sort of depth of memory or search. My sense is that where the blog world is going is the reformulation of those communities of interest as federated collections of sites, and that, you know, what we haven't yet seen, but there's no reason why we can't, and every reason to expect that we will, is that then you're going to have, you know, 15, 20, 30,000 different, if you will, PageRank algorithms, right? Each of which is appropriate to a particular set of interests and to a particular context, you know, and we just haven't gotten there yet, you know, but why won't we, right? And wouldn't that, you know, go a long way toward helping us out?
I think it will. I think there's always some big challenges in selecting appropriate algorithms. But maybe one way to look at it is a lot of those algorithms will actually be people.
Exactly.
Back in 93, I was teaching at the University of Michigan's Library School, and I was teaching my students how to be experts in specific topics of information on the Internet.
Mm-hmm.
And this is back in Gopher days, if you mm-hmm. can imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those people actually created Gopher sites that they, on specific topics, and parlayed those class projects into jobs. Like jobs is like one as a VP at Excite in the day, back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still convinced that there is a growing likelihood that there are going to be these sort of specialists, topical specialists, that we pay a fair amount of money for their help in whether it's finding information and how to deal with a child has come down with diabetes, or certainly we see it in financial services already and probably a lot of other areas.
Well, there's no question about it. I would rather pay a travel agent mm-hmm. at this point than have to deal with the travel sites, because I don't know, other people seem happier with travel sites than me, but I just don't have the patience to develop the necessary level of expertise to make the most out of those sites. And I know that there are people who have that expertise, and, well, actually they have access to superior information systems
right.
as well, but I agree.
Well, the interesting thing is the edge is not going to be in access to superior information.
It's going to be in search strategy. It's going to be in knowledge of... Exactly.
And dedication. I do this. This is all I do, and
yeah.
that's why I can offer the service at a reasonable price to you, because I don't have to figure it out anew each time.
Yeah. Well,
interesting if circuitous conversation.
Yeah. why don't you say a little bit about what it is that you hope to do next in the world of publishing?
As a past author, I've had the privilege of being published by a great company, as you know them to be, O'Reilly. But I think, like a lot of entrepreneurial types, I'm always looking to do things on my own and think I could maybe even do a few things better. And the beauty of starting any company in an established industry, but from scratch today, is you can really leverage the internet and all kinds of great things that are powerful and cheap. So earlier this year, I launched Rosenfeld Media as a publishing house dedicated to short, practical titles on user experience design.
These will be books? These will be combinations of books and online resources?
These will be print and PDF. Mm-hmm. You can buy one, the other, or both. And we have three books signed right now and more on the way. We should start seeing that first batch come out end of this year, early next, including the book on analytics mm-hmm. that I'm co-writing with Rich Wiggins. The idea, partly, is that user experience is this thing that a lot of people talk about, but we don't really know what it is. We do know that it's interdisciplinary, which means it is something of an aggregation of sorts, where knowledge and expertise and methods from many different disciplines are being put together to solve new challenges. And the challenges are that things are getting really difficult and complex to design. And people who design things, and I'm talking about information designers, information architects, interaction designers, graphic designers, content managers, you name it. We're all designing things. Well, we can't just make it up anymore. We actually have to have data and other knowledge to inform our design decisions. And we have to be professional. So I think because we're under that pressure and because we don't really know what user experience is, I want to help define it by developing titles mm-hmm. that are just about user experience. Mm-hmm. And I want there to be a lot of user input in terms of what titles to develop. So let's define user experience by defining topics that books should be published.
Hence the survey.
Hence a variety of surveys and a new service that I'm hoping will launch toward the end of the summer, which is very much a mashup of many things related to UX books. My model is one of stakeholding. Why can't people have a role in the books they use? Why do those books have to be monologues in the age of mm-hmm. the internet? Why can't they be dialogue?
Why can't the prospective readers pose questions that they'd like answered and spec out the book in advance?
Exactly. So as part of the infrastructure that we provide each author is a movable type-driven book site. And we're actually posing a lot of questions, sharing a lot of content, having a lot of discussion about each book's mm-hmm. topic on these sites, which will really help drive book and its quality, but also make more people feel like they have a stake in those books. And we're also doing things that a lot of publishers don't typically do, from what I can tell. One is some innovative ways to find out what topics people want to have covered. Another, just eating our own dog food, doing things like testing the designs of our books. So we're actually going to be creating prototypes and putting them out there for people to bang on and improve the design work that goes into the book as a system.
So you want to take a different approach to the production of books, but it still is the production of books as we know them. What's your thinking on the degree to which, well, in particular in an area like this, the ability to tell the story most effectively resides in other media, online, interactive, screencast-based, you know, audio augmented, mm-hmm. You know, as opposed to a PDF with static screenshots, right? I mean, I feel like I could. Well, I know that I could demonstrate so much more online. I mean, how economically to make that work is of course a crucial question. But I mean, from the perspective of delivering what it is that I'd like people to learn, I can't think of a better way to do it.
Well, that's a great point. And one way that we can try to address that is by essentially putting it out there to potential readers to ask them about what formats they respond mm-hmm. to well for practical books,
mm-hmm.
or practical topics, I should say, and to put it out to the authors as well. And the way I look at it is, you know, I'm creating a platform, I'm creating infrastructure that should be reusable. So each book site, I have to basically press a button when I sign a new mm-hmm. author and they get a book site that's pretty well developed and flexible. I need to be able to do the same thing with things like a screencast or other means of teaching.
Well,
thanks very much for the opportunity. It's been a really fun conversation.
Likewise, I mean, I've known of you forever, and this is one of the great pleasures of doing this series is I finally get a chance to kind of hook up with all these people that I've always wanted to have a conversation with. So, yeah, thanks.